just first encourage the two panelists to pick up on anything the other one said and kind of go at each other for a few moments before we open it to general questions.
You want to go first? So I did have a few things that I wanted to note. So on the right side of the ledger that Mr. Millick, I should mention, this not having your PhD done. I was called, it took me so long to finish my PhD at the University of Virginia that Jim Caesar called me the graduate student emeritus. It was funny, but it was also meant to humiliate me to induce me to finish, which I eventually did. There's nothing wrong with taking a long time. I'm certainly not going to say it is. So the first thing I would note is that on the right side of the ledger, there are institutions. And this is one of the curious things about the analysis here, which isn't to correct or dispute. It's more just to sort of show you, like we got on the left, we have the press, the universities, K-12 education, Fortune 500 companies, mobs, big tech, administrative state, military, and the intel state. And on the right side of the ledger, we have 28 out of 50 governors are Republican. 54% of seats are held by Republicans in state legislatures. 30 out of 18 state chambers belong to Republican majorities. And we basically have the Supreme Court sort of almost, except Bostock, which was maybe not the best. We will probably have a House majority, maybe a Senate majority. And so what this tells you is that all of this this cultural and institutional power on the left gets you that. And so when they're fully mobilizing these resources, conservatives and Republicans, generally speaking, still have some pretty serious advantages. And so what you'll end up with, if you at least take some of the advice that Arthur's offering, is perhaps a much more significant outcome. There are just a few things that I would be worried about. The first is that I'm not a fan of subsidizing skills. And the reason for this is that I'm still enough of a classical liberal to worry that we're making bets that on markets that may not exist. This has been one of the routine problems of like government training for displaced workers, is that they get trained in coding and then they go out and nobody wants to hire them because we have too many coders. But that's partly because of the issue that I thought you got very right, which is that one of the reasons for the heavy emphasis on skilled labor immigration is because the United States does not educate its own workforce. Rather, the workforce is educated in institutions that are mostly patronage systems designed in order to reward people from upholding a progressive point of view, so K-12 and university educations. So the only thing I would want to avoid are things in which we were creating special interests, especially because the trend in creating special interests in Washington this way is that they're loyal to us until they don't need to be, and then they flip and take on the other side. That's exactly what the Fortune 500 company did. There's not an internal disciplining mechanism for that kind of activity.
Yeah, thank you. Those are very very important things that should be addressed. So on subsidizing skills, the vast majority of federal funding that goes to the sciences is for building up a cadre of graduate students who are going to be the next generations of physicists, chemists, etc. So that's subsidizing a skill set. You can't have the kinds of scientific laboratories that we have without that kind of federal funding. I mean, that's known. So there are skill sets that are subsidized, and your example is great about coders.
Yeah.
Everybody here, I suspect, remembers during the Bush administration this mania, what are we going to do with all these workers? We're going to teach them to code. Well, first of all, it takes a special kind of person to want to do that, a special kind of soul that will sit through such things. And second of all, that ended up being, one of these, one of these falsehoods that a certain segment of conservatives told to themselves and to the public so as to allow the continuation of migration into the country. The lie being that, no, we'll retool people. Those people that, cost $25 an hour to be a plumber, we're going to get somebody from Latin America to do that for $10 an hour. All the corporations want that. All of the local small businesses want that, too. We're going to tell this lie about coding, and we'll see how it goes. And it did buy off some part of the right. I mean, so anyways, There is, Germany also subsidizes basically apprenticeship programs to learn skills, and I think that that actually works well, and I'm not saying that necessarily the federal government should do it. I'm perfectly open for the states to do that too. So that's one. This kind of encouragement, as I said, just like we did during the Cold War, we encouraged the best to go into certain fields and created channels and supported those channels for them to do it. So that's number one. Number two, your more serious objection to my comment. Well, it's true that we own all of these legislatures and governor's mansions. I know also Jim Caesar, who I admire deeply, and he and I had this dispute in 2010 where he said, man, this is really the moment for conservatism to rise. He's not the only one that said, it's really the moment for conservatism to rise. We, in that year, owned two-thirds of the state legislatures and said, yeah, well, the country got worse. Just because you own those things doesn't mean that you own them. You know, what ends up happening is that you don't accomplish altogether very much at all. I agree, by the way, that the example of DeSantis, especially what he's done with Disney, was, in my view, extremely impressive, and it shows how the right itself has shifted. It would have been unimaginable 6 years ago for that to happen, and the right would have said back then, like, oh, you can't do that. Five people said it, but this was a huge success. And more of that's to come. So I do agree with you, and that's why I ended my talk with the states, because I do think that there's hope. But just because you know you own something doesn't mean you're going to make use of it. Whereas my argument is, well, the left does own things, and they make really good use of it.
Yeah. Should we go?
Okay. Are you?
I did want to say one thing about federal funding for academic interests. DeSantis is contemplating or may have already done a thing in Florida. I'm extremely opposed to him running for president because then he will no longer be my governor. Rescinding a specific accreditation body for higher education called SACS. And the reason this is important is that accreditation becomes the means by which universities receive federal money in the form of student loans. And SACS was imposing increasingly onerous sort of charges on schools that especially affected mission-driven schools like Ave Maria. And so the idea of turning this into a more optional variety means that there's an opportunity for what? Something that conservatives typically don't think of, which is you could create an accreditation body that is more of a conservative accreditation body. We could have our own. And one of the things that's often missing from conservative state houses is a conception that they can just change things. They actually can wield this, and it's not in a sense that they're going to like use state power to impose things on people. You can just liberate people from monopolies that have existed for a long time. And it's not even that you know the outcome will be this like you know we're going to go in there with the guards and we're going to impose all kinds of new social orders. It's you know you can just free people up from all kinds of activity, and often state houses don't even know that they can do this or where to start.
Okay, can we go to questions, or you want to go at each other some more?
I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. I told you this was going to be a love.
That's
okay,
exactly.
Please line up at the microphone, and while you're doing that, I'll start with questions from Slido. There are several questions along this line, so I'll kind of combine them. One from Jace Linkton: how would the right get into a position to wield power to fix things without just giving the left more power? And from Alex Salter, what safeguards can the right build to ensure new government powers aren't wielded against them? And aren't we committing an own goal, shooting ourselves in the foot by pointing to government as a solution to this? So if each of you could just say maybe a little bit more about those lines of questions.
Yeah, go first. Okay, thank you for the question, whoever you are in the ether. This has been a thing that conservatives have been saying for as long as I can remember, namely, you know, aren't they going to use this against us? Well, a lot is already used against you. It happens relentlessly, and you just kind of take it. And that's going to keep going on, and it'll get worse, I suspect. So in terms of an own goal, I mean, I don't know, is it an own goal to help America's working class? by building up certain skills? Is that an own goal? Is it an own goal to, you know, build up, as I, this example that I gave, I can give other examples, build up Johns Hopkins Medical School for there to be, you know, one person that is studying from the perspective of, you know, science and not propaganda, anyways, as I conceive it. Transgenderism, is that really an own goal? Is it an own goal to protect the goose that lays the golden egg in terms of scientific innovation through laws and prevent adversarial regimes from stealing those things or from companies that, again, have benefited from being in America, of just giving those things away for, you know, one quarter of higher earnings? My view is that those are our comparative advantages in the world, and they have to be safeguarded. And there are a variety of ways to do these things. So, okay.
I this is the ring of power problem, right? You know, that Galadriel says in the movie, the good Tolkien adaptation. You know, it's like, all shall look upon me in despair, right? If you were of a certain age watching that, if you're a younger person in the room, that's probably like nightmare fuel. Kate Blanchett's kind of a great actress, but the thing is, like, the reason that we have less to worry about, not entirely something to worry about when it comes to advancing a kind of use of state power, is that first of all, there's Article 1, Section 8 exists, right? It's right there. It's meant for use, and it's for that purpose. The other thing is that we have elections. So if there's things that are used and aren't very good, and elect new people, and you're like, that doesn't seem to work. Members of Congress don't seem to want to listen to any kind of party discipline. And that's when I say, well, go listen to Joe Postol's talk and hear about parties, and don't listen to Michael Greene. And that's the solution, right? Is that political parties used to provide a certain level of discipline, and they would handle these problems before. I mean, you want to talk about the misuse of power. I mean, just go look up what John C. Calhoun tried to get away with the tariff of 1828. I mean, you know, it's some pretty crazy stuff that's happened in the past, and this is during the good old days.
Dan.
Yes, Daniel Lowenstein. The only affiliation I'll repeat, because it's relevant to the question, is I'm director of the UCLA Center for the Liberal Arts and Free Institutions. I think one of the wisest things that's been said about politics in recent years is that politics is downstream from culture. And one of the proposals you mentioned, Professor Millick, was to create a cultural institution. Now, obviously, given what I do, I'm all in favor of that. But what I think makes it extremely difficult is that it's very hard to define what it should do in terms that really control what it will do. And even if a Republican administration launched it, I'm just afraid that in the next Democratic administration, it would just turn out to be another one of those strengths of the left. And I think that concern is probably especially applicable to that, but it probably applies also to many of the things that you mentioned.
May I respond? Thank you. Look, it's a good point, and I've tried to qualify all of my words by saying that, you know, there are people here in this room that know more than I do about these topics, and there are all sorts of consequences, possible consequences, like you just said, but let me just push back on this for a moment. So I know that the right likes to talk about politics being downstream from culture. Okay, but in a certain way, it's the reverse, too. So, for example, some big part of America is now, in one way or another, for transgenderism. Well, was that because of politics, or was that because of culture? I mean, there was a huge apparatus deployed on the American public, in various places, various, various very intelligent places, I should add, very impressive, that Obergefell clears the Supreme Court, and literally on a dime, the next issue was transgenderism in 3 months.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing lightning speed, amazing organization, and amazing ferocity. And a great deal of the American public has been persuaded by that. So, you know, that was politics very directly influencing culture. Now, on the flip side of what you said, you know, no, I think that the federal government should speak unambiguously about what it stands for. And it clearly stands for, you know, some kind of constitutional republicanism. And we're already inundated. I mean, if you walk through D.C., the propaganda is relentless on every bus, on every street corner, just accosting you. So I think that it already exists, is what I'm saying. And I think that the right should have something like this to give, first of all, that part of America self-confidence, you know, in some kind of understanding of what they think the purpose of the government is, what the purpose of the country is. You're right, it'll be used against us, but it already is.
I just want to point out something. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do the thing. I'm going to talk about universities. All right? We've held back long enough.
I tried to avoid it, yeah.
There is an asymmetry to this issue where that what causes many times conservative elites to buckle is that they don't want to send their kids to conservative universities. They want to send their kids to elite universities, and they want to carve out a place for their children at those universities where they can be safe. And because they're elites, they are. And as a result, they retain a control over prestige granting that conservative universities simply will not possess. And so in order for there to be a university outside of Hillsdale, which has a rapidly gaining set of prestige, there needs to be conservative prestige granting elite universities, which means that you have to call upon conservative elites not to send their children to Harvard. And that is one of the hardest asks you can put forward to someone, especially because they're often the primary donor to your organization. You may be in the room. I'm not calling anyone out for this, right? You do not see a corresponding problem where progressive elites are like, I really want to send my kid to the University of Dallas. You know, like, it doesn't happen. So one of the reasons why the patronage for the universities is something that is a good idea is that it provides that kind of alternative. There's one caveat to this, which is the last time the federal government got into this game, a lot of the universities they funded, which had prior to that been religious and mission-driven colleges, just, you know, they evaporated that mission as soon as possible because they could rely on an alternative source of revenue. And so there's always costs and benefits to consider.
Give your money to the other school that starts with H, a very good and important point. I'll go to the online question now. This is from Carmen Rodriguez. Different groups along the political spectrum use the term common good. Will there ever be consensus on a definition of it, or what's the alternative, or I guess do we need an alternative language to support the display of public power?
So the way that is the wrong way to define the common good, I find, is to start with a kind of like, these are the things that I like, and you should like them too. Right? That is often how we get the common good presented. If you disagree and you will not, then, you know, there's probably some inquisition that they'll get started as soon as they have the wood. The actual way of approaching the common good is to essentially assume that that people have a variety of interests that mean that in most cases the good here is a private good which deserves some degree of liberty to dispose. Where we find the common good most generally appears is that, at least when it comes to, this is in the context of politics, is usually civic peace, which is that it's something that from which everyone benefits and there's not a scarcity. If you provide that kind of peace, normally the way that you'll do this is by allowing people to pursue their own daily lives in a way that doesn't allow for them to overstep their duties. In this case, the pornography example is a very good one. That's obviously a misuse of liberty to engage in human trafficking that way, but also with minimal attempts to violate conscience, because conscience right is something that a person has, and it's inalienable, and so you can't have the state start trying to be moral for you and to impose that moral view on others.
I don't disagree with a word of that, but really, there should be some consideration for, you know, how to safeguard some of those rights, you know? And it turns out that you need enforcement, you know? That the right of to freely associate has been trampled upon. I think most people in this room know. Same with the freedom of speech. Same with the freedom of conscience, as you've said. And to, you know, and if you have a state that is not really interested in enforcing those things, protecting those things, but has an opposite view, then you need your own institutions that will have enough power to halt somebody's tyrannical inclinations. And my complaint is that the right only kind of has those things, and the trend is against them. Nobody talks about the freedom of association. As I said before, with big tech, you know, platforms that are effectively the public square at this point. The right was like, should we do anything? Will it determine the outcome of an election? Well, can't touch them. That's it. Here's that right. So.
Graham.
Graham Walker, Independent Institute. Logically speaking, there is a way to split the difference, since the constitutional order, states retain very broad moral and other police powers, which the federal government does not possess. And so could one support the use of state powers for moral and social goods while opposing the use of federal power for moral and social goods? Conversely, are people like us in this room, are we capable of opposing the use of federal power for moral and social goods without automatically also opposing the use of state power for moral and social goods? And maybe even more practically, are state constitutions themselves obstacles to the use of state government power for moral and social good, insofar as many states have mimicked or replicated the federal constitution for their state constitutions?
Ah, man, this is a rough one. So the way that I tried to, I feel like what I'm about to give is not a complete answer. So I'm just going to let you know that that's what's about to happen. The way that I put it in the talk is that state governments are often market opportunities because they're areas in which there's very little in the way of concentration, considering the federal government possesses so much unilateral discretion over so many issues. Part of that's because of things like incorporation, doctrine in the courts, and others is because of like the sort of overreading of the Commerce Clause. And so the one weakness to focusing on the states is that where litigation eventually appears, sometimes they all overrule. This is the Obergefell problem, right? Where like states like turned out in droves to ratify state constitutions, and then, you know, sweet mysteries of life, Kennedy decides that, you know, there's another way to go. That is the game in town in many cases with the states. It doesn't always have to be over social issues that have as much heat behind them as same-sex marriage did in the teens. A friend of mine does, for example, a rural hospital rescue in Tennessee, and that's a moral issue. It's access to health care. And for a while, Democrats were actually very happy in Congress to leave these areas underfunded through federal subsidies, because the faster those hospitals fail, the sooner they'll be able to make an argument for socialized medicine. And so he found in these states market opportunities to get these hospitals, and he immediately started to interface with Tennessee State House members, some of whom are pretty crazy, as it turns out. But once they learned about this, they were not too crazy not to say yes. And so he's facilitated the process of restoring these hospitals in a way that make them competitive and profitable and market driven. And so in this case, what the moral issue that the states have been able to deal with is they've been able to rescue their hospitals from federal intervention, which would be mismanaged. And the good that's been provided here is access for health care for a lot of rural poor in Tennessee. And so that's what I mean by market opportunities, both in the sense that there are actual ways of people to make money. This guy's doing okay. I sat by his pool. I saw it. I'm sure he's doing fine. But the other thing that's a market opportunity here is there's not a lot of action by the opposing party and progressives. And the reason is that they want to build up the federal government to oversee all of this. But again, there's always like imperfections to these solutions, and the Obergefell problem is the imperfection here, where if it's a heated issue, the courts might just come in and snatch it all away after you've done that work.
Okay, let me go to the online questions and bring you guys, you don't want me to do this, but I'm going to bring you down from the clouds and ask you a very practical question. There's a couple of very practical questions here that I'll combine. It's so obvious we should be staffing the swamp. I have to assume someone has tried. The left is just better at it. Why? How do we fix that? And why would the administrative state hire committed conservatives? Don't we have to get hired to build up the administrative state in our favor?
I'll have something to say, but...
Sure. I think that's true that the left is far better at these things, and part of the reason that they're better is that they have very well-established pipelines and that have been paid attention to for many years, and those pipelines are called Ivy League universities. So there is a mismatch in that regard. There's no question about it. Moreover, they, as I have seen, the right in the last generation invested a lot of money in a variety of things. 10 years ago, you could ask any, from older to younger conservative, why do we have free trade? They'd recite the same three arguments like this. So a lot has been invested into getting that into brains. Not a lot has been invested into having these talent pools expanded, where people are trained to do these things. So that's one example. But there's a more obvious disadvantage, which is that the right is not very good at protecting its own, and the left tells the right who to fire and who to ostracize. And when the right and when the left says it, the right's like, okay, yeah, you're right. We should do that.
This has just happened to me, by the way, so I can...
Right.
There are
these mismatches, these moral mismatches, a kind of moral power, and then these channel mismatches. But there are some solutions. I mean, I basically think that a lot of an administration should be staffed, or let's say the federal bureaucracy should be staffed more by people from rural America, who have seen the rest of America, who are, not bought off because they want to go to Lockheed as their next step, and do everything while they're in that job with a view to going to Lockheed or whatever, with the expectation being that they return. I spend a lot of time in rural America. It's really smart people with real skills. There are alternatives. We just draft from the same pool relentlessly and get the same outcomes.
There's an old saying, I don't even remember who said it, but some here might remember it, which is that the United States is really competition between new dealers and car dealers.
That's good.
Yeah, and new dealers are good at building large, centralized progressive institutions that distribute patronage to clients that are willing to, trade on whatever they're doing. And so the formation of the Ivy League cartel for progressive staffing thereby requires a kind of series of purity tests that conservatives have to jump through. This is less the case than it used to be. A lot of this is to the credit of Hillsdale University and for essentially filling the gap for a lot of conservatives that are looking to hire outside of that milieu. But the other problem is that if we look at car dealer versus new dealer, car dealers are people who own their own businesses tied to a local area that provides work and revenue, both in terms of tax revenue to the county and state, as well as revenue for their employees. They're not people who understand patronage. They are directly opposed to the idea of patronage. This is why all you have to do in order to get your typical car dealer Republican mad is just look at him and say, tenure. And he's like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. And the reason this is the worst thing ever is that he wants to be able to fire a person who doesn't, have a monthly sales objectives met on a routine basis. But tenure is a source of patronage. And so, of course, people want to hand out tenure to those who are willing to provide the right kind of training for the right kinds of people. So one of the solutions to this would be for a robust defense of private property that would allow for more car dealers. Not necessarily more people selling cars, but if you go to Ave Maria University, you'll discover very close is an area called Immokalee, which is where many of your tomatoes are grown. And in Immokalee, there are many Guatemalans, and none of them are citizens. And what they do instead is they're hired as day laborers to contractors who then serve as the insulation from the large owners for liability for hiring illegal immigrants. So, you know, these people will sort of fade into the wilderness whenever there's an immigration run. And when you're on Facebook in that area, you'll regularly see people using the Facebook market as a way of telling you where the INS agents are. The reason this matters is that were these people able to become citizens and buy their own land, Immokalee wouldn't look the way it does, with vultures walking on the streets and yard birds all over the place. Instead, these would be productive citizens, and if this was done by Republicans that were willing to defend their rights to private property, they might be natural constituents in the way that we see Hispanics trending. Now, this does have a policy problem, right? Is this not rewarding migrants coming to the United States illegally? And unfortunately, that is the case. So the way that you would have to deal with this, you'd have to have border control. But in the meantime, why not create a constituency based on more robust private property protections so that rather than subsidizing very large landowners in Florida, you can be more productive in the economy by having these people go from being contractors as illegal aliens to landowners that can be productive in their area.
Just to add one last point to the about the staffing question. I'll be quick. There were a lot of people that exited the Trump administration who, by virtue of doing whatever they did, which was not very political, but like, you know, nuts and bolts of policy, were unemployable.
Yeah.
All of the institutions circled their wagons. All the law firms said, no, you're Hitler. Does that ever happen to the left? I don't know. I don't think so. Direct Path, Apple, Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera.
CNN,
that's right. Disgraced people are on CNN. Not that CNN is particularly bad, I just have some examples in my mind. So the right doesn't have that cushion where people would go and make interesting, important policy decisions because they know that it's over after that. Nobody will touch them. So this is one thing that the right could actually fix.
Go back to the microphone.
Carl Zeebarth, transportation consultant in Dallas. This is a very pointed question to both of the speakers. And you've just been talking about the staffing of the federal government and the fact that we have this amorphous blob that controls our life. Did you follow the proposed recodification of the civil service regulations? I think it specifically is Section 14, which was floated by the Trump administration in about the second year, which would have permitted the president to take civil service status away from about 20,000 of the most important bureaucrats and make those positions appointive, not subject to Senate confirmation, but appointive by the administration. Did either of you dealt with that? Either of you aware with that? I suspect the only person in the room that knows about this is Don Devine. But
he should answer.
But I believe that would be at least a major step. Now, what actually happened was that Trump went out of office before that was codified. But it was an administrative action that was within the legal powers granted to the president in terms of classification of civil service positions.
That's a good question. Maybe use it to comment more broadly on civil service reform, what you think might be done.
Well, I'll just comment on that directly. Even though I'm speaking out of turn, and I'm just going to mimic a very smart person that I know on this question. It's basically, the problem is that, number one, it's going to be challenged in the courts, and it may take you 4 years to get that clarified or not. And by that time, you know, the administration may be over. So that's one thing to consider. Number two, from what I, again, taking this smart person's opinion as the truth, from what I understand, the trouble is that even if you do that, there is still a very large swath of people who have a great deal of power that wouldn't touch. So I'll give you one example. I know this as fact that the Trump administration was interested in obtaining data from the IRS about how employers were classifying their employees when they didn't have social security numbers. In other words, they were likely illegals. And the IRS said, we're not going to turn that over. After 6 months of slow rolling and passing it there and passing it there and passing it there. So that's just, you know, a president just wants a data point. They speculated on what the president was going to do with that data point, and then they internally decided, well, we're just going to run the clock out. So would that, you know, Schedule F change something about that dynamic? Probably not. So it's a, so again, my sense is that that's another one of these silver bullet solutions that won't do as much as we hope it would, although it should be a part of a broader approach.
I have nothing to add. That's good.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let me go back to an online question. Phil Magness asks, most universities are a little more than subsidized careers for professional leftist activists. What are your thoughts on turning off the taxpayer spigot? And let me just add to that. How, practically speaking, could we do
thoughts.
That? What kind of case could we make? Wait, there's probably a sense in which we're all in favor of that, either turning off the spigot or redirecting the spigot or something, but how do we build the case to actually do that in the real world?
So I'm just going to plug my work because I'm a self-interested academic, but I wrote something called The Time for New Institutions is Now, New Universities is Now for Law and Liberty, where I talk about this. Probably one of the only sort of Reagan-era positions that's never really been updated has been a kind of hostility for universities on the basis of faculty being in charge of like a tenured radical department that is diluting and malforming the students. What's actually happened is that a lot of the reforms that conservatives wanted, they got. They wanted a more market-driven approach to university education, which means that you're now going to respond to students as consumers rather than as people subject to formation of the values of the institution. And what they wanted was wokeness in many cases. It's what they went for. And so there's a very large administrative problem at the university level that provides for that kind of welfare. So the faculty are often sidelined and subject to a fair amount of discipline if they don't comply. And so what's amazing is that the thing that has been able to allow many professors that are conservative at these universities to hang on by their fingernails has ironically been tenure. The thing that conservatives spent a long time campaigning against is really the only thing that's around anymore. A book that everyone here should read is by Josh Dunn and John Shields called Passing on the Right that talks about this problem. And the best thing about Passing on the Right is that if you're of a certain age, you can kind of figure out who they're talking to when they're anonymous, right? You're like, oh, I know who this professor is. I know which university that is. So I won't say who how many I think I got right, but it is a problem at universities that there is a lot of professional activists that are employed there, but where they're actually employed are normally in administrative positions that, as I keep saying, are more or less there for the purposes of patronage and for hunting out a dissenting thought. So do we want to strip these things of taxpayer money? The answer is yeah. If they're public institutions, then there needs to be a certain amount of financial discipline imposed on these universities. But another thing you can do is you can charter new ones. We're not stuck with just the ones that exist now. As I say in the piece, and there's a couple really great articles I say in the Law and Liberty piece at National Affairs, starting a university is not that expensive. It sounds like it's going to be expensive, but that's because you're thinking about like starting engineering schools. Well, you know, that is going to be expensive, but that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about staffing, the people who are designing servers for Cisco, or not Cisco, it's a food service. Anyway, you don't care. We're talking about the formation of people who would be more likely to be placed in government. What was it?
Cisco.
Okay, yeah, I got it. Never mind. I'm awesome. The other thing that this is more one thing that you should always be careful of when you're on the right is you don't want to always imagine policies that exist merely to own the libs. But the one that I do like the idea is taking science grants that are extremely onerous to apply for. There's entire careers dedicated behind grant writing. People who are lead investigators on scientific research often do none of the research because their job is to be essentially the avatar for this broader project, is to make those now lotteries.
And the idea would be that it would just, this money would just go to different institutions to fund different things. The other thing that this is another sort of like almost owning the libs kind of policy, is that to the extent that the federal government has provided largesse to universities to provide these resources, then those resources need to be open to other researchers. I'm not sure if that's a policy that's already in place, because I'm not that deep in the weeds on higher ed policy. But it is a shame that a lot of the highest end research money that's gone to many of the different universities is kind of locked up behind the grant donors. If this is the people's money, then maybe more than just these individuals should have access to these sorts of things.
Just a very quick addition to all of that is that, you know, a lot of these universities, everybody knows, everybody's been, you know, following for so long what has happened to the humanities. And so, you know, if you take a big research university, things are not good at the humanities, but they always say, or they would say if really pushed on it, but look at all the scientific research that we're doing. Yeah, yeah. They hide behind it. Yeah. Well, okay, well, a lot of that is federal funding, and that can be taken away. And it should be given to, you know, we have federal labs that are, you know, really good, and really smart people have worked there for many generations. That money can be given there, and these places will be, you know, in a tough spot. Yale gets $500 million a year, every year, for scientific research. A lot of those scientists, I suspect, would want to move to that lab and be around, you know, good laboratories, good graduate students. I mean, there are ways to do these things. It's not, universities don't have to be doing science. That's our tradition, and maybe it's worked out for a long time, but scientific research does not need to be housed there. And that's a huge power. You know, my view is, somebody asked about regulating morals in the states, having police powers. Well, I mean, I don't think I believe in seditious libel, and I don't think that, you know, cultivating young people intentionally to despise the country, despise, you know, its history, its parents, that should be federally subsidized by states, excuse me. It's fine. We have the freedom of speech. It's fine to have those thoughts, to read those books. That's fine. But why would are we so insane that a state would, you know, continuously support creating citizens like that? It doesn't have to. There's no obligation to do so. That's what we have to liberate ourselves from, is to continue to think that, no, we have to go down this path with small, you know, changes, a center here, a speaker there. You know, you're free citizens. Your legislatures represent your will.
We'll have time, I think, for one more brief question and brief answers before we have to break for lunch.
Guys, hi, you know me, and my firm is a professional institution that tries to help grow other institutions, many of whom are in this room here. But the point that you were making there, Arthur, at the end is similar to the one you made earlier about how there is this revolving door in Washington between the private sector and between the government, and that kind of creates this regime, as we call it. And part of it is because it isn't just the exchange of grants, for instance, that you're talking about, James, oh, make it a lottery of where these grants go to, but it's the contracts that go from the federal government to private companies, who then the federal government becomes their number one client. I mean, PricewaterhouseCooper and Lockheed Martin and all these different places, and also Microsoft and Google. And I mean, we can, you know, like Elon Musk for, you know, one reason or the other, but his biggest client is the United States government with all its various subsidies. So the question, I suppose, that I have is, should we also be looking at how contracts are awarded? Are they being awarded to institutions who are ultimately enemies of our values? And then how can we change that?
Well, maybe I don't have a full answer. It's a very important question. I don't have an answer, but maybe just two very small thoughts. Number one, the logic may be somewhat of the opposite of what you just said, namely that it's the government that says, well, we will contract only with, you know, a company that has disparate impact and can prove its disparate impact. And so then the company, to get that contract, becomes what the demand was, you know, on them. So it would actually be a matter of changing that. And look, I don't know, there are people that have thought more about this than I have, but that seems to me within the realm of the possible, you know. That's number one. Number two, yeah, I just think that, look, I understand that, you know, former officers, former generals, they do have a real expertise, you know, that's needed. But there's something wrong with, you know, serving your whole life and then going off to make a really big amount of money, more than what you made, to trade on your contacts. You know, and we have grown to think that that's like normal, like they're entrepreneurial. Well, no, but I mean, maybe some people shouldn't be allowed to do such things, because these are sensitive matters. And maybe, you know, in a class there should be like a certain kind of honor. You know, like, I've served my country and I was never in it for the money. It disgusts me that you would think that. You know, that's the problem. And then the massive amount of money that is then pooled to friends. That's partly the explanation, not the full one, but that's partly the explanation of this vast growth of contractors upon which, you know, the government relies, and especially DOD and the IC. You know, well, we serve together. He provides a good service. Maybe he's going to hire me next. And then, you know, that little chain will continue. That has to stop, just as, like, conscientious taxpayers and people that want, you know, transparency. I mean, we always say transparency and we never get it. But it's like, you know, something along those lines. And the honor that should be there to say, I was never in it for the money.
Final 10 words of this session.
So the government needs to have more state capacity to manage its own affairs. A lot of contracting work that's done now is stuff that the government used to do itself, with much better employment and much more professionalism, with obligations and sense of duty to the state. The other is that the person who probably did the best short analysis of this is this very handsome and intelligent man on a YouTube channel called Learn Liberty. So if you just go to Learn Liberty and you type, you can't give money away, you will see none other than Professor Michael Munger talk about this very problem.
All right. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you.